Today, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about some shrub intercropping systems. You should use the mouse, right? Just right here. That's so weird. I'm going to have to mess with this a little bit, guys. Okay, I'm going to use the arrows then. Okay. Sorry. I'm going to talk to you all a little bit about some shrub intercropping systems today that are in the Sahel, which is just south of the Sahara Desert in Africa. But before that, before I talk to you about the specifics, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the background, about where we're researching, and why it's important. So, Senegal is the country in the red box, and then I zoomed in there. It's on the westernmost side of Africa, and it is also in the arid and semi-arid region, which makes sense because it is on the southern border of a pretty famous desert. The agriculture that is there is mainly millet and peanut. Peanut is the cash crop, and then millet is the food crop. It's usually farmed either just with a hoe or with the horse, as you see here, and they depend largely on rain, which is what rain-fed means, if you didn't know that. One of the difficulties of agriculture in this region is that the soils are particularly old and degraded. They don't have very much organic matter or very many nutrients. This becomes an even larger problem when you consider the growing population, and that Africa is expected to be one of the major contributors to growing world populations. If you look at the society or some cultural norms of Senegal specifically, but also across the Sahel, they tend to use aggressive agriculture, which is expected when you have large populations, and they lose organic matter and also nutrients. A problem that we run into a lot, I'm sorry, I'm a little bit sick, so I apologize. A problem that they run into is chemical fertilizers are expensive, and most of the farmers in that region are subsistence farmers, and they can't afford to fertilize up to the recommended amount. And so usually they just use about 11 kilograms per hectare, which is not a lot. It's actually very little, especially considering that these soils are generally 95 to 98% soil, sand. Luckily, these shrubs, oh, actually, we have another picture of these shrubs. If you look at this picture up in the corner, it's one of the sites that I was doing my research, and you can see these little green dots. These little green dots are the shrubs that grow there when nothing else does, and they are Pileostigma reticulatum and Gyria senegalensis. Both of them are native to the Sahel, and they grow all the way across. We're only looking at the ones in Senegal, but they're the same. And they've been shown to increase yields when intercropped with both millet and peanut. They're pretty cool. The way that they work is they create islands of fertility, also called resource islands, in these desert regions. How they do that, or these are some of the effects or characteristics of that, they stabilize the biomass, and they add organic matter, and they can provide nutrients, and then they maintain the water content even during dry spells. So even when it's not raining, the soil around these shrubs are particularly moist, and one of the reasons suggested for that is hydraulic lift, which is the idea that the shrubs have really long taproots that go 4 or 5 meters down and can find water that other crops can't and pull them up. And so during the day, they use it for photosynthesis, and then during the night when it's not photosynthesizing, it allows the water to go out into the soil surrounding and get into the millet. Other research, not mine, but in the same lab, there is some research about arbuscular mycorrhizae fungi, which might help with that. And then there's also some other research into enzymes that, if you look again into the corner with this picture, that is a picture of a research field where on the, you're right, I guess, the millet is not intercropped with the shrub. It's just alone. And then on the left, it is with the shrub. And you can see that it's very obvious the effects that the shrub is having on the millet with the height. That may be due to just the organic matter nutrients and water availability, but there are also some very interesting enzymes that might be taking part in that. Currently, the farmers are cutting the bushes down and burning them so they don't allow them to grow, which is not the best. Luckily for us, they come back, so this shrub was cut down, and then it grew back once the rainy season started again. So what I would like to do is I would like to characterize the microbial community within the influence and also outside of the influence. So I characterized with inside the influence as the blue ring, and that's within a meter of the shrub diameter. And we called that near, which you'll need to know for later data. And then the one in the red boxes are about 2 meters from all shrubs. So it's not just from this shrub, but it's from all shrubs. And we designated those far. Another expectation is that, so what we expect is that the bacterial community will decrease in both size and diversity as it goes away from the shrub. We also expect a water stress effect as it becomes drier. So the red arrows show a tendency towards less diversity. And then in the map, it shows as it goes up towards the drier region, we would see also less diversity and then also some stress markers. So in order to demonstrate that, we had some samples in the north, in the center region, and then in the south as the rain regime changed. And then we took them to the laboratory in Dakar, which is the red dot. At each site, so we had 6 sites, if you didn't count, there were 6 little sites. At each site, we chose 6 shrubs, and then we took 5 samples at each spot. We took 1 near the shrub, 2 near, and then 2 far. And we did that for 2 years with a total of 360 samples. In order to analyze them with a fatty acid methyl ester method, I'm going to make sure you all know exactly what I'm talking about before we go into the data. If you look at the little figure that says fatty acids and glycerol and phosphate, that is a phospholipid that is very important for cell structure and very different for each taxonomic group. And if you look down right below it is a bunch of examples of the fatty acids, which are basically just long carbon chains with either methyl sticking off or an unsaturation element of a double bond or a cyclic element. And then we can use this method, which I've outlined very briefly. So we take this top picture with the fatty acid and the glycerol, and we take it apart with a base, which is the potassium hydroxide, and methanol. And then we can turn that into a methyl ester, which is that picture over there. So that R represents any one of those long chains. It could be any one of those. And actually, there are a lot more. Those are just a few. And then once we have those fatty acids, we can neutralize it with an acid and then mix it with hexane because like dissolves like, and fatty acids are organic. Hexane is organic. They go together. And then we can basically purify them a little bit more and then run them through a gas chromatograph and then compare them with a library provided by MIDI. And that will give us, which will label these fatty acids as biomarkers. And those biomarkers will indicate what taxonomic groups we have. Unfortunately, you can't see that. I spent a fair amount of time with PCORD, which is a software that can do PCA, which is polycoordinate analysis, and you can use it to tell the differences between lots of different things, but there weren't any that I could find yet, and so I'm still looking. I have not separated out the specific biomarkers, and then there's a few other things that I haven't done yet. But what I've done so far, I haven't seen any obvious trends or obvious groupings, so that's too bad. But I am still hopeful that I will find some. And then this is an example again of no statistical difference for the one-way ANOVA. So when the PCA wasn't working, I was like, maybe the one-way ANOVA will show me something. A direction that I can go in, but these are comparisons of the under, the near, and the far. There's no statistical difference there. I have some ideas why that's so, but yeah, I have not lost hope. An interesting thing that came out of it was that, so these are portions of the groups, and I grouped them largely into bacteria, fungi, and protozoa. The bacteria, they all were at roughly the same ratio. So you had 60% bacteria, about 38% fungi, well actually 40% fungi, and then like 0.005 protozoa. And it was the same under the shrub, near the shrub, and far away from the shrub, which I was surprised at, but I expect to see differences when I look into specific biomarkers. When you looked at the north, the location difference, there was differences. So if you look at the, again, far left, that's directly under the shrub. So we compared under the shrub in the south, central, and then north, and we compared those against each other. Then near the shrub, north, central, south, and then far from the shrub, north, central, south. So there were a lot of differences from the north to the central to the south under the shrub, which is something that I wasn't expecting, because I would have expected the stability of the soil to buffer that change. But and then near the soil and then far away from the soil, there was largely no significant differences. In the future, I'm hoping to break the biomarkers into different groups and find some good graphs to show you all next time. And then also, another person in our lab used this exact same soil and analyzed the enzymes. And so I would like to compare with her and see if they have any mutual effect on each other or if they're connected. Thank you for your time and attention. Does anyone have any questions?
So is there any problem with harvesting the crop when those shrubs are allowed to grow in there?
No, the way that they harvest, no. They do it by hand and also by horses, and so it's just largely picking it anyway. So they just sort of like, and also when they're planting, they just sort of run over it. I don't have a picture of it, but someone in the lab does. But yeah, they just kind of ignore it and walk over it. It's not a problem. In Senegal, they don't really use it that effectively. But in other countries, I have heard they are better at creating an efficient intercropping system. I haven't seen them personally, but by word of mouth, I've heard that. Yeah?
Why do they irrigate the shrubs? If they do the shrubs, do they benefit? Outweigh the reason that they agree with the shrubs for?
Sorry, can you?
So the first one, why do they irrigate the shrubs? Do they get more area for the
crops? No. Many reasons, but I think a lot of them are cultural. It's good to have a clean looking field, but I think most of them are cultural. I have not heard of any agricultural practice reasons. No, because they plant right by it. So like. I've in a bunch of these shrubs, I would take a sample, a soil sample from a shrub where its root system is like right here, and then there's a millet growing up right next to it. They don't compete for water, and they actually help with the water. So it does take up space, but they grow right next to each other. It doesn't affect how many millet plants you can plant.
Mm-hmm. If you can show this difference in yield for the millet, have you gotten more farmers to not leaving the shrub in place rather than?
We haven't tried that yet. No, there's also some other work that we're doing. Is we have some research fields where we spread the litter from the shrubs over a designated area to make the near the affected influence of the shrub larger, and it seems to be having some effect, but we're still currently looking into the most efficient way to use it, so it wouldn't be great right now to be like, do this, without actually having looked into which is the best way to use the shrubs.
Thank you.